Poetry on the Radio, poetry in and around the ACT. Today, the first of two episodes with Ross Donlan, plus the Rhyming Bugle, poetry news and events from around the region. I'm Kimberly K. Williams. Today, and on next week's episode, we speak with Ross Donlan. Sydney raised, he now lives in Castlemaine, Victoria. He is widely published in Australia, Ireland, the UK, and elsewhere. He has written 5 full-length books of poetry, most recently The Bread Horse, and numerous chapbooks. His honors include the Varuna Dorothy Hewitt Flagship Fellowship in 2010 and winning 2 international poetry competitions. A sequence of his poems from his book The Blue Dressing Gown about his father, a World War II U.S. serviceman, formed the basis of a radio feature on the ABC poetry program Poetica in 2013. Ross Donlan will discuss those poems on today's program. Ross convenes literary events under the banner Poetry from Agitation Hill and is the publisher of the poetry imprint Mark Time Books. Our conversation revealed a lot about how poets may create poetry from their life stories, even phantom aspects of their biography. Reviewing your books, there were a few things that I've noticed that I really admire in your writing. The poet Mark Strand had this way of writing and talking about what isn't there and using poetry to talk about the ineffable. And I think your poems do that incredibly well.
Oh, really? Nobody's ever said that to me before.
One of the poems that I specifically had in mind is Old Rakes.
Oh, yeah.
From Lucidity. Lucidity is Mark Time Books. I think your father, you've written a lot about him, and just when you think you're done, he comes back. And I wonder if your penchant for writing about what's absent perhaps comes from that.
Ah, that's interesting. He's certainly a very powerful presence in my life, even though we never met. My father was a U.S. serviceman who was out here during the Second World War, met and married my mother, Peg, and of course at the end of the war he had to go back to the States to be discharged. He was from Louisville, Kentucky, and not an educated man. He was, at the outbreak of the war, he was an unemployed handyman in a brewery. And probably been unemployed during the Great Depression, of course. Went back to the States, worked a little. There was a recession at the time. Made his way to San Francisco, pursuant to coming back to Australia. I think there was some thought that he'd get seaman's papers. He couldn't afford the fare, of course. He was a drinker, and so finally died in the Ferry Hotel in San Francisco at the age of 34. So for a person who was never in my life, in fact, he certainly has been a presence all my life. I think I'm done with him writing about him because there was a big sequence that's in The Blue Dressing Gown. Then he pops up every now and again, so I find I still write a father poem probably several a year, and one came up recently called The Quiet American.
So The Blue Dressing Gown is yet another poem.
Sure.
Like I'm describing.
This takes up all the information I had about him, which was literally in a shoebox in a wardrobe at home. So it contained a couple of letters, some postcards, some birthday cards, coroner's report, a letter from his mother, something from his sister. And I answered a number of these in poems. So even things like the telegram about his death, I replied to that. And I wrote a poem as if I were the man watching him write a letter from the Embarcadero YMCA in San Francisco. Mm. I wrote a letter as if I were him at the moment of his death. Yes, I wrote a letter about my mother's first contact with him and so on and so forth. So there was quite a lot there. And first time I discovered that I didn't have a father as such, I wrote a poem about that. And The Blue Dressing Gown, eventually. And the poem, ironically, maybe, has been very kind to me. It's opened a lot of doors. It won something overseas. And I was introduced to a circle of people in the UK that led to festivals and a very nice time as a poet in many places. I wrote a poem called Kentucky Rain. My father was from Louisville, Kentucky. So Elvis Presley got mixed up with that. And so the poems you're referring to comes from a sequence called Relics. The first one's called Archives. Saved to explore on a rainy day, his Pacific Theatre archives leave not much war to look at. Stamp-sized sepia photographs, three letters, handful of cards for birthdays, well short of a pack. Piece of cardboard with scribbled notes, modest collage of brown leaves crumbling to white. His war on a newspaper map. 2. The American's wallet. To think it was once snug at his hip and held plenty of wartime money, enough to buy Peg a compact and chocolates from the Paragon. His hand would have palmed the smooth, yielding leather, two or three fingers prizing notes or nipping the slit that held a ticket. It was among the few anchors left, chains rusting across the Pacific. I sometimes hold it like a hand holding mine, like touching skin. 3. The blue dressing gown. It hung in my boy's wardrobe, an army regulation item no one could throw out. And it would be hard, wouldn't it, to discard the only thing left in something like the shape of him. It hung on a wire hanger, skeleton of his shoulder cutting across collarbone, the drape of it swinging side to side, if nudged into a shy dance, or if asked up by a breeze. I used to wear it, with no sense of feeling weird or spooky, alternating with a practical flannel. Yet at night, sometimes woke, frightened by its doorway shadow, a man hanging on the moon's hook. I never realized I'd outgrown him, walking tall through one summer while his shoulders rode my back. The tassels swung like incense as I walked in his shape, trying to sense the being inside him.
This sequence really exemplifies what I'm hinting at. This idea of, I sometimes hold it like a hand holding mine, like touching skin, right? This idea of the imagination bringing things to us, but it's so ephemeral, right? It's just for an instant and then it's gone again. And then that's the gown, right? The gown is the one object, the one material item. And the poem hangs so many images on it. It's so beautiful.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, I remember writing it vividly. And I was in Hobart at a residency. And I'd been writing a lot about him. In fact, I can tell you a kind of a spooky story, if you like. It's a very sweet story. I'd been writing about him for about a year. I won something for in Varuna, the writer's house in outside of Sydney, called, someone joked, it's the longest award in Australian poetry, the Dorothy Hewitt Flagship Fellowship. Not the richest or the most famous, but the longest. And I took all this information with me out of the shoebox. And I was there a month with only him and me, so to speak, apart from some other people resident there. And he had been stationed at the Hydro Majestic, a really weird place, if you've ever been there, outside of Katoomba, in Medlow Bath. And so I went there. It was closed under renovation, but I looked around, wandered around, came back. And I was writing poem after poem after poem. Every time I switched my head on, wherever the poems are, another poem, it came out about him, another one. And then eventually I was in Hobart and the blue dressing gown came out one morning. And I just wrote it straight out. And I got as far down as sometimes woke, frightened by its doorway shadow, a man hanging on the moon's hook. I thought, that's great. A man hanging on the moon's hook. And I went for a walk down to Salamanca, really excited. Went into the writer's house there and discovered that there was a poetry competition going on in the UK. And Carol Ann Duffy, English poet laureate at the time, was the judge, chief judge, through the Avon International. And I really like her poetry and I thought, wow, I wonder whether she would like my poetry. And I went back to where I was and I thought, I wonder if I can write any more. I wonder if I'm done or do I want to finish with that, I thought, terrific image of the man hanging on the moon's hook. And I did. And I got another 6 lines. And really the poem kind of takes off in the last 6 mm-hmm. lines. And getting to the very last line, trying to sense the being inside him, and I thought, that's great. That's so ambiguous. Does it mean to sense the my being inside him, or does it mean his having been inside the dressing gown? And I sent it off, and it won a prize in the competition. It didn't win the overall. It won the Wenlock Festival Poetry Prize. I discovered by asking them whether I'd been shortlisted. I thought, you know, I knew I was longlisted. And I thought, I'm going to go. I haven't travelled in donkey's years. I'm going to go to London. I don't care if I come sixth. I'm going to go. So I did. And they said, yeah, you're in the shortlist. So 1 of 6. And I won the Wenlock Festival Poetry Prize. The director was there with the poem who helped me. I didn't even have a copy of the poem with me. So I read it. And they invited me to read at the festival. I ended up reading at 3 festivals, and then things went on and on and on after that, all down to a poem. But the story gets better than that. There had been no contact between our families, I mean, for decades. I couldn't tell you how long. They weren't writers. After he died, when I was 5, I think, apart from telling us of his death, I think there was virtually nothing. And I'd spent about a year thinking about him. I even Googled to see the place where they lived in Louisville, and wrote as if I was his mother, if I was his sister, a man looking at him, like I said, even wrote as if I were him. Okay, so Ron Pretty published the book and sent it to me from Wollongong on the day I got the carton of books. I got an email from a child that's on the cover of the book, now a woman in her 70s. She said, I'd seen your name in a Louisville paper, and I can't get your name out of my head. I've become kind of obsessed that there still must be a Ross Donlan somewhere in Australia, a little angel, she said. Well, she got that wrong. She said, look, it's probably not me, not you. But you seem to have an interesting life as a writer. But of course it was me. So on the very day I got the book with her photograph on the cover, I got communication. And so the families got back in touch over after 40-odd years. And I spoke to them on the phone, sent her the book, and she said it was the most important book in her life.
Wow.
So isn't that a lovely story?
That is. That really is. Could you talk a little bit more about the cover?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I'm interested in covers and titles. I had some friends strongly advocate that I not call this book The Blue Dressing Gown and Other Poems. A friend wanted me to call it The Ferry, I remember, because he was in the Ferry Hotel when he died. But no, I wanted to call it straight. It really was a book about the blue dressing gown and other poems. And on the cover, there's the last known photograph of my father. On the day he left Louisville, Kentucky, to go to San Francisco. So there he is, much aged, my mother told me, with his something in his lapel, looks like a war badge, and his niece and nephew, so his sister's children. And there he is in the family home, about to leave, poor man. And
so those are your cousins?
Yes.
Yes, your first cousins.
Yes, I spoke to Eddie. Mm-hmm. I never spoke to Angela, but she wrote a lot. And over a couple of years, and was back in contact with my mother. She sent my mother toffee from the church in Louisville where she would work. Mm-hmm. I'm not Catholic, but my family was Catholic. And I remember my daughter counseling me not to send the book because there's some fairly graphic love poems in there. I said, oh, no, Catholics are very broad-minded. That'd be cool. And they loved it. Mm. So isn't it a beautiful story? It's a very sad story. But it's, in a way, it got to be beautiful.
My Poetry on the Radio co-host, Peter Searles, asked,
there's a poem in the book which seems to respond to that photo. Would you read that one for
us? Oh, yes, sure. Yes, I know the one you mean. Yes, this is on the open page, the one poem is called Photograph of Peggy. It's my mum, just after she was engaged at in Ashfield, where I was born and raised in Sydney. And the other page says photograph of Bill, Louisville, Kentucky, 1946. A year of peace has yet to make him a civilian. Despite the pressed suit, collar and tie, ex-serviceman's badge gleaming like a talisman on his lapel, he still has war in his backbone. The hands clasped behind him try to be at ease. His face juts for the camera, jaws set, shoulders braced, almost a 40s comic book character, fearless Fosdick, Dick Tracy, Joe Palooka, are sure he's going to make it. He is packed, hair oiled and combed, so hard you can see his scalp. Mm-hmm. Standing beside his niece and nephew, a dark tower at the backyard going away, the lines of weatherboard on his parents' house stretch behind him to a vanishing point. I didn't say fearless Fosdick very well. You don't say that very often.
No, no. Actually, though, because the lines trouble just a little bit, it really called attention to the sound, which the sounds are gorgeous.
Thank you.
You know, so.
Yeah, Phyllis Fosdick was a character with a really square jaw, you might know, being an American. And mm-hmm. Joe Palooka was a boxer.
Mm-hmm.
So I used to read all of those, of course, as a kid. Dick Tracy with his phone, which we now do today, you know, 70 years later or something, we're talking to our phones, but Dick Tracy was doing it in the 30s and 40s. So, yeah. And it makes me think, why did they call him Fearless Fosdick? The fearless I get, but Fosdick? What's that about? It's funny, of course, as I grow older, I realise that when I'm reading a poem, sometimes I have to do a little bit of explanation, which I don't normally like before you read a poem, but otherwise they're not going to get it. And it's just a different time, different culture. Everything's changed sort of massively, really.
Mm.
This book was adapted into a radio show. Could you tell us how that came about and what the show was like?
Well, after I'd finished the sequence, it occurred to me almost immediately it would be beautiful for radio. And I knew of Mike Ladd, who ran a program called Poetica on Radio National. And at some point, I sent the book. I didn't know the man. And said, look, I think this is made for radio. And I never heard, of course, for a long while. Like a couple of years, maybe. And then I got a letter from him saying, yeah, you're right. It'd be great on radio. So he put me in touch with a fabulous producer in Melbourne, whose name, unfortunately, I forget. It's a long time ago. And she did a terrific job. She came up to interview me in Castlemaine with the birds. I remember caroling in the background at the back of my place. And then there were actors involved. We talked about what would be appropriate music. I had some thoughts. They had some thoughts. And put it together so I had a feeling of the 40s. Mm-hmm. And the acting was brilliant. You know, they told me, because my father was from Louisville, Kentucky, they were able to go through their archives and find out what an accent would have been like in Louisville, Kentucky in the mid-40s. And so the actors adopted those accents. Apparently he had quite a soft twang, I gather, not deep south.
Yeah.
And I wonder whether they lived in a shotgun house. I love that idea, of course. I thought, wow, there's a poem I haven't yet written. In fact, you could open the front door, apparently, and shoot a shotgun down the hallway and would go out the back door without hitting anybody or anything. It must be a very simple house, just with a central hallway and rooms off to either side. And they lived down near the dock, near the river, near the railway line, so poor people. It was a tragic family, actually, when you know more about them. There were several sons, I think three. One died of pneumonia. I think he was working in a car plant. Made me think of Philip Levine.
Yes.
A poet I love.
Oh, I love Philip Levine.
I love him more than you.
No. I'm from Detroit.
Oh, okay. I think you win.
He was too.
And, so one of the sons was died of pneumonia working in a car plant. Another one was killed in the barroom brawl. And then my father, dead at 34. And he was the oldest one to die. But the daughter survived. Hard-working Irish-German family. I think they were mostly factory workers. Mm-hmm. I suspect hard workers, hard drinkers.
Yeah.
Of the time.
Yeah. Ross Donlan's poetic use of that shoebox of memorabilia of his father, with its tactile artifacts, helps him project his readers into different times and voices. He says he does return often to the places and sensations of his life.
When I was in Sydney just now, I'm prone to want to go back to places which have got power for me and memory.
Mm-hmm.
So I went back to the flat that I was raised in Bland Street, Ashfield, and got to the front, and a Vietnamese woman came out. Ashfield has lots of Vietnamese people living there now, and it's great. And it's, child's point of view, adult point of view, so strange and weird and marvellous.
Mm-hmm.
So I said to her, I said, hello. She said, can I help you? I said, I was born here, I'm looking up. And we chatted about that. And I said, look, can I walk around the around the back? And she said, yeah, of course. So off I went down the sideway and out the back to see where I used to hit balls up against the wall. It all seemed so much smaller, of course.
Yes.
Everything changed, but everything's still the same and full of flashbacks and ghosts and extraordinary power. I went to Ashfield Park, where I kind of grew up. Wandered around the streets to see what was there and what wasn't there, and I can't tell you what a powerful emotional experience it was. Then the room, which was my bedroom, and the front room, and all the games I used to make. Being an only child, of course, I had what's that expression? A rich interior life. So I have a rich interior life. It does, I guess, I suppose you can't generalise, but certainly made me, I guess, highly imaginative and very conscious of words and adult behaviours, and you're an observer.
I call that collecting poems. When you intentionally do something that is going to really make you, even though everything's in the exterior, this is a place, right? It's geographic. But you go and it does something to you interiorly. And then the poems sort of become the place where the external and the internal meet, right? And you work it through the language. So I call that collecting poems. And now all you have to do is write them.
Mm. They're coming. I mean, like I said last night briefly, I'm fortunately in a couple of collaborations at the moment.
Mm.
One with Jaden Webb here in Canberra.
Mm.
One with Trish O'Hare in Melbourne. Trish is writing sonnets and I'm replying with guzzles. Which is really curious because it's almost as though someone would throw, 100 words in front of you on a table, and for some reason that one speaks to you and suddenly you've got a poem. So I have been writing things that I would never have written in a million years if it hadn't been for this process.
Mm.
And most of them are about my childhood. I'm very aware of my mortality. I say, I see it kind of leaning over the fence looking at me. And so I'm going back to childhood again and again, and how I began to write poems or thought of poems as a little boy, what I heard.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I have got one of looking out the back window of that flat across to Ashfield Park.
Poetry on the Radio producer, Peter Monahan, observed.
I was struck last night in your reading by how much your writing does capture a sense of geography. You so deftly create a sense of the sort of physicality and different perspectives on a place. And as you're reading the poems about the dressing gown hanging there, it has a real sense of the place evokes the person, and the gown and the absence in the gown evokes the person. But it all has a real rich sort of physicality, materiality.
Because what the poem requires, right, is for you to do this in so few words. And then it's before you, the listener or the reader.
It's interesting you say that. I like to be clear. That's one reason why I called my second book Lucidity, because I thought the reviewer, and I think the best, although it's a very small review in the Sydney Morning Herald, in a way got me better than anybody else, I think. And I loved what she said. This is Karen Goldsworthy in the Sydney Morning Herald. She said, in a review of The Blue Dressing Gown and other poems, the appeal of Ross Donlan's poems lies in the combination of technical skills with unusual lucidity. Donlan is interested in the many refined techniques of poetry, but not at the expense of storytelling and straightforward emotion. And I remember reading somewhere in Melbourne, and a person came up to me and said, anybody could do what you do. And I was really glad, because it must have seemed easy.
Yeah.
And I really liked for it to seem easy, although, as we know, sitting here is very hard to That's get right. it so that it sounds easy.
It does seem easy, and it is easy on the reader. I definitely found that easiness coming through, but I was never once feeling that it's easy to do. It's easy to yeah. write in that way. No, I wouldn't have thought so.
I worked with Judith Rodriguez, who I guess you could say was a kind of mentor. And I was writing, I do like to write a light poem. I like to make people laugh.
Mm-hmm.
And she said to me, Ross, you know, some of your poems are frankly popular. And I thought she was paying me a compliment. And I realised it was sort of a warning. But no, I love to make people laugh, you know, or cry. And that's one reason why one of the sections of this book is called Frankly Popular. So they're deliberately too. And I know when Jeff Page has reviewed my work, he often refers to the ones that have made him laugh. And that's nice. There's not much of it about. They pinch things from all over the place, from things you hear on railway stations, aeroplanes, side of bottles, you know, if you're pregnant or having to conceive, don't listen, that kind of thing. And how, you know, oxygen masks could fall from the ceiling, or you should maybe hold tightly to somebody else, or if you want to leave a poem, wait for the line breaks and full stops and then slide underneath and so forth.
Eating chips with Jane Austen.
Yeah.
I love that one.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
On next week's installment of Poetry on the Radio, we'll hear more about Ross Donlan's effective use of humor, both in his poetry and in his way of presenting poetry at readings. There'll be poems about eating chips with Jane Austen and about Madonna and much more. I'm Kimberly K. Williams.
The Rhyming Bugle. On Monday, August 28, Reconciliation Day in the ACT, at Smith's Alternative in Civic at 7 p.m, that poetry thing is a big open mic. Readers have 3 minutes to present their work. On Monday, September 4, at Smith's, Jeff's Poetry presents Jeff Goodfellow and Suzanne Edgar. Jeff Goodfellow from Adelaide seeks to give voice to people who generally would not go anywhere near poetry. His 1990 collection was No Ticket, No Start, Poetry from the Building Sites. Poems for a Dead Father was shortlisted in 2002 for the Age Book of the Year Award. His 2001 memoir was titled Out of Copley Street, A Working Class Boyhood. He launched his verse novel, Blight Street, in 2022. Suzanne Edgar was raised in Glenelg, Adelaide, before moving to Canberra, where, while working part-time at the ANU, she wrote short stories and later poetry. She's published 3 book collections of poems with Port Adelaide publisher Stephen Matthews, Ginninderra Press. And here's advance word that on September 25, Monday at Smith's, 7 p.m, The Book of Birds, an anthology of bird-related poems, edited by Leyland and Lepkowitz, will launch. Poetry on the Radio is produced weekly on unceded First Nations country in the studios of Art Sound FM and airs Sundays at 4:30 p.m. and again at 10:30 p.m. on Mondays and online at artsound.fm. Series hosts are Kimberly K. Williams and Peter Searles, who produce the program with me, Peter Monahan. Find out more on the Poetry on the Radio page under the Programs tab at artsound.fm. The music on today's program is from Australian pianist Gabriella Smart's album Chinese Whispers. Our theme is an imagining of an ancient Greek hymn to the muse Calliope by Gregorio Paniagua and the Atrium Musica de Madrid.